KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
It is an unbelievable, irresponsible arrogance that we are seeing coming out of Kim Jong-un at this time.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley responding to North Korea's ballistic missile tests earlier this week. We'll bring you the latest on the situation in the Korean Peninsula and discuss the escalating tensions between the United States and North Korea. Then Alexis Madrigal will join us to discuss his new radio documentary, Containers, which looks at the history of the Bay Area container shipping and the role those giant metal containers play in the development of global capitalism. It's all coming up on Forum after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. After North Korea launched four ballistic missiles into the sea earlier this week, the United States announced the deployment of a missile defense system in South Korea. Worried that this aggression could start an arms race, Chinese officials attempted to mitigate the situation. They promised that North Korea halt its nuclear weapons program in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea suspending their joint military exercises in the region, a proposal that both the United States and South Korea reject. In this half-hour segment, we'll bring you the latest on the situation in the Korean Peninsula and discuss escalating tensions between the United States and North Korea. And joining us here in studio is Philip Yun. We welcome him back to the Forum program. He's Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of Plowshares Fund. Previously, he was a Vice President at the Asia Foundation and a Senior Policy Advisor at the U.S. State Department. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Good. Good to have you here. Also good to have Jonathan Marcus with us again. He is in London. He's a diplomatic and defense correspondent with BBC News and joins us from London. Jonathan Marcus, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning to you both.
Good morning to you. And let me begin, if I may, Jonathan Marcus, with you. This latest turn of events, particularly after the launching of those four ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan, does not necessarily bode well because China has come out with some threats. That has to do with the defense system, which we'll talk about, that's being set up, the so-called THAAD system. But at this point, we don't seem to be progressing really at all toward even talking, do we?
No, I think North Korea is shaping up to be really the first major test, the foreign policy test for the Trump administration. I think what's really worrying is that for a long time up to now, the debate has been about the parallel development of North Korea's nuclear capability, but also its missile capabilities, with a concern in the medium term, certainly in Washington, that the North Koreans might acquire the ability to launch an intercontinental range ballistic missile that would directly threaten the United States. Now, leaving aside the fact that it has lots of shorter and medium range systems that threaten U.S. installations in Korea and Japan and so on. But I think what many experts fear, the latest missile tests show, and these fall actually into a pattern of earlier tests. These are not tests of components or elements of a very long-range intercontinental missile system. What they are and what they're being interpreted as by the experts is actually an early test of North Korea's potential nuclear warfighting capacity, its ability to target and hold at risk U.S. installations, other targets in South Korea and in the region more generally. And I think that is something that should be sending alarm bells ringing in Washington as well.
Well, Philip Yun, a lot of these concerns that have been expressed by North Korea about military exercise perceived as a threat to them, they're saying, in effect, and I think Jonathan Marcus is right, we can attack if there is a real attack. In other words, we can fight back and attack back, I should say. Counterpunch, as perhaps President Trump would say. And President Trump is probably very much in their minds now, I mean, in testing him, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. What North Korea does and what they should be doing and are doing are testing him. They're probing right now. And I do think in certain respects that that's what this series of four missiles that we just talked about was about. North Korea hates these military exercises. They look at it as if there is going to be a preemptive attack on North Korea. that it will be at this time. And these four missile shots shot earlier this week were in direct response to these exercises. It was a warning saying that we can and will escalate. They also wanted to show technically the ability to overwhelm the missile defense, that they have the know-how. And
these are missiles that are harder to detect than to destroy, aren't they?
Well, what they're trying to do, what they're saying here is the THAAD system, which is basically a system of radar control panels and missiles. What that tries to do is essentially hit a bullet, a flying bullet with another bullet. It's very technical, very hard to do. You can track these, but actually hitting them out of the air is something that is technically very hard to do. Now, the Japanese have a system. They're going to put a system in South Korea later this year. But at this point, what they're showing is that these things can be overwhelmed. If you put too many in one space, you can't hit them all. The other piece is that the North Koreans are known to have what we call countermeasures and decoys, which when they go off, they shoot something else, and then it's possible those missiles will go after them. And the idea is of the four missiles, at least one will get through.
And Jonathan Marcus, let's talk about China's role in this whole equation. I mean, now we have actually Chinese ban on all coal imports from North Korea, which really is pretty serious money. We're talking about, 30% to 50% of the total trade that goes on with North Korea. And China was supposed to be the leverage against North Korea. China was supposed to be the linchpin that would somehow bring North Korea to heel. But the reality is that that's changed tremendously now. Aren't they kind of saying, you know, this is your problem in the West, the United States and so forth, and also warning us because of the THAAD system?
Well, certainly the Chinese would like to see the North Korean nuclear program gone and would like to see the North Koreans restrain themselves. At root, the Chinese still believe that it's U.S. and South Korean military provocation, as they would put it, that is underpinning North Korea's concerns. The coal sanctions are interesting. It is a significant measure imposed by the Chinese on the North Korean economy. One imagines this has far more to do with the murder by North Korean agents of Kim Jong-un's half-brother in Kuala Lumpur Airport, who was in some sense under the protection of the Chinese, rather than their concerns about the missile or the nuclear program. So there are tensions there. I think the difficulty is that China wants kind of contradictory things. It does want to see the peninsula nuclear-free, but it also wants to see stability in North Korea. Its horror is the idea of the North Korean regime collapsing and millions of refugees flooding across its border into Chinese territory. So it's very difficult. And then, of course, there's the third aspect of this, and this bears on the THAAD missile defense system. There is China's strategic relationship with Washington. China doesn't like THAAD. It doesn't like THAAD not so much because of the missile interceptors, because it is a system intended to strike short and medium range missiles. So in that sense, it wouldn't have much impact on the Chinese long range strategic deterrent. But what China doesn't like is the radars that go along with the system, which reach deep into Chinese airspace to monitor what is going on there, to detect launches of weapons. And the Chinese believe, with a certain amount of reasonableness, that these could be used to queue up other defensive systems deployed in the United States. Now, it also has to be said that America already has some of these radars in Japan. It has a THAAD system of its own based in the territory of Guam. So what extra ability the radars based in South Korea would give the Americans, I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, it's a little bit of an analogous situation to the missile defense rows that we have with Russia in Europe. You have a system which is designed to defend against a potential Iranian missile attack, but the Russians say no, one day it could be developed, it could be expanded, components of it could be used to devalue our strategic deterrent. The Chinese in many ways are making very much the same argument apropos the defenses that are being based in South Korea.
Jonathan Marcus, so good to have you with us, and I appreciate the time you've spent with us. Again, Jonathan Marcus is diplomatic and defense correspondent with the BBC News, and we will continue with Philip Yun. Before I go to him, I want to go to you and invite you to join us in conversation here, that is, you, our listeners. Our toll-free number is available. This is only a half-hour segment, so if you want to weigh in on what's been going on with North Korea, or if you have have questions or comments, the time to call and the time to email is now. Our toll-free number is yours. It's 866-733-6786. We do invite your calls. Again, that number for your calls is 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Philip Young.
So one of the things I wanted to add to what Michael just said, there is another – we have to realize that the U.S.-China relationship is much bigger. And there are other strategic reasons that are of concern here related to North Korea. Not only are the Chinese worried about a collapse because it would – bring refugees into China. They're also worried about the fact that a united Korea would be presumably under South Korea and that the United States would have access to the Chinese border directly. That's a big strategic consideration for them. So while they have a common goal with the United States of a nuclear-free Korean peninsula, in terms of priorities for the Chinese, the much higher priority is preventing U.S. troops along the Chinese border, particularly when there's so much dispute going on in other regions of Asia between the United States and China.
Let me, before I bring our callers and emailers in here, and again, you can join us at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. There really are no good options here, are there? I mean, I hate to put it so pessimistically or grimly, but the fact of the matter is it's appeared that way to me for quite some time. And if anything, it just continues to get worse because they're tending to escalate more. They're doing underground tests, too, which we haven't even mentioned.
Exactly. This North Korea and how to deal with North Korea is the land of absolutely lousy policy options. I mean, when you think about them, we are not going to, nor we can, allow North Korea to have an operational nuclear arsenal, which in the next 5 to 10 years, they could have 50 with the capability of hitting the United States. At the same time, there's no option really to use force. The idea of what's going on now is talk of a preemptive attack by the United States on these missiles. You're going to invite the huge possibility of another Korean War and thousands of casualties in Seoul. Just 50 miles away from Seoul, there are 14,000 artillery tubes that could rain down on Seoul, a metropolitan area of 25 million. So realistically, we are not going to use force. So the only options that we have available are what we're doing now, which are sanctions, pressure, going to the UN, which has not done anything.
Now, but what about political legitimacy for them or guaranteeing them some kind of economic sustainability? It's always been assumed that that's really what they want in all this.
No, exactly. So this is the third option, which is essentially it's got to be a political solution. And so in exchange for what I think is a freeze, which is doable, you are going to give them some sort of security assurances, some political legitimacy, as you just talked about, and some way for them to sustain themselves economically. That's what the package is going to be. Fairly straightforward. It's just getting to the table. And at this point, the United States and North Korea are not talking.
And in the meantime, the Chinese are warning of an arms race because of this defense system. And it's volatile. I know a lot of the talk in Washington is that this could blow up. I mean, literally blow up. But let's hear what our callers have to say. Let me go to Andrew first. Andrew, you're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. My question is, to what degree do your guests think that our capacity to respond in terms of public pronouncement has been hamstrung by President Trump's self-inflicted credibility wounds? I think you know what I'm saying, right?
Well, how much is at this point, since President Trump can't be second-guessed, it seems, one statement to the next, whether it's a tweet or whatever, how much does he play into this whole equation? We heard Jonathan Marcus saying earlier that Kim Jong-un are probably testing him. But this is someone who has been, you know, pretty bellicose in his rhetoric, and so is Kim Jong-un for that matter.
Well, exactly. So one thing is we don't really know what the Trump policy on North Korea is right now. There's an issue where the State Department and key appointees who are going to dictate policy are not in place. So right now I can't say anything about Trump policy because I don't quite frankly know what it is. There's a larger layer here against this whole backdrop of war games where this thing could spin out of control, and this is exactly what you were talking about. You have Kim Jong-un, who is relatively young, somewhat a little more tested but still untested. He is known for being very aggressive and likes to be unpredictable. It seems to me that arguably you could say Donald Trump is has that kind of goes in that kind of direction as well. So when with deterrence and nuclear weapons, where perception is everything, the whole notion of deterrence of whether you're going to do something, you've got a very, very volatile mix of leaders here in terms of how they're going to respond. And what you need here and what the Chinese are trying to do is to cool things down so people can act a little more predictably, so an accident or a miscalculation, which would be catastrophic on the Korean Peninsula, does not happen.
Well, there's been the analogy of this to a slow-motion train wreck, literally, I mean, in terms of over the weapons and missile arguments that are going on and deep tensions that are going on. I want to thank the caller and bring another caller aboard here, and that's Chevy. You're on. Morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Could you give us some insight into what factors, you know, come into play when such a system, the missile defense system, has to be deployed somewhere? Who pays for it? And who's the manufacturer? And, you know, do we come across to the rest of the world players as if we are using this situation to sell something?
Those are good questions, and you'll take your answer off the air. Philip, we're paying for this.
We are paying for this, and this is a system that many in Washington argue about whether, in fact, whether it works, whether it doesn't. The reason why decisions are made can be philosophical. So there are some people who say this thing really doesn't work, therefore we shouldn't deploy it. There are reasons why some people will oppose it purely for political reasons. Well, you're a Democrat, I'm a Republican, and I do think there is an economic aspect to this, where there are there are manufacturers that are going to benefit from this kind of deployment. And I personally think that if it's a technology that will work, it is worth exploring. But as far as the South Koreans are concerned, I don't think they should put a lot of solace that this is actually going to be 100% effective, because it will not be.
Again, Philip Yun is here with us in studio, Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer for the Plowshare Fund and previously Vice President of the Asia Foundation and Senior Policy Advisor to the U.S. State Department. Let me go to more of your calls. I'm going to go to a caller in Alabama next. Josh, you're on.
Hey, I have a question. What about going the other way with it and helping China in it, North Korea, and let them take control of it?
Well, That would be one approach to do it, one approach, but I don't think the North Koreans are actually going to allow them to do that. There is no love lost between North Koreans and South Koreans, and I think the whole idea of China taking over North Korea is something that's the last thing that they would want to do. They've got enough issues on their own, let alone having to deal with North Koreans who don't want to be under their rule.
And let me thank the caller and go to some of your comments. A listener writes, before the Trump presidency, we had a reckless and crazy leader in North Korea. Now we have two, as the impulsive and dictatorial policies of Donald Trump will make the conflict with North Korea far more dangerous. Another listener writes, North Korea is basically an imperialist Machiavellian dynasty. Allowing a family to sit on an entire country isn't just anti-capitalist, it's anti-communist. It would help if North Korea would change leadership every few years, like China, then North Korea would flourish. It doesn't happen because China doesn't want it to. And Ben says, since the Chinese military is currently in ascendancy in that part of the world, wouldn't it make sense for them to cut their teeth by taking down the North Korean regime? And there again, annexation, one caller says, taking down the regime, another caller says, this is not quite as easy, I think, as some people would like to think.
They have a formidable military.
Yeah.
They have over a million-man army. They probably have a couple of nuclear weapons that they could use. They have deterrence, so no one's going to touch them. And this is something that they know, and this is what's driving this particular activity of developing nuclear weapons, because of these kinds of conversations. So they have, in their mind, they have a lot to fear.
The caller talks about this as a Machiavellian dynasty, and that's probably close to the mark. I just wonder what your thoughts are, Philip, about the assassination of the half-brother, because it's been so much in the news, and some feel it's kind of a distraction from this slow-motion train wreck.
Yeah, I think in certain ways it is. It takes away from some of these larger events that I think are more significant. But there are a couple things that I think are worthwhile to talk about. First of all, at first I thought it was not necessarily North Korea sponsored, that it was something maybe a gambling debt or something like that. But it's clearly North Korea sponsored. So it's puzzling. It's puzzling on a couple things, and I don't necessarily have an answer. One is—
Excuse me, why do you say clearly North Korea sponsored?
Because the use of VX gas and those kind— the fact that the embassy and the personnel there were state— North Korean foreign ministry people makes me see, there's a government patina around this. Now, there are conspiracy theories that there are people who are trying to undermine Kim Jong-un on this, but I have no idea. This is all speculation. The first thing about what was puzzling for me is this is not a usual North Korean operation, though. North Korea has, for better or for worse, has been incredibly efficient and very professional when they decide to do something like this. This was amateurish. The second thing is timing. When they do things, it's all coordinated, and here it was definitely not coordinated. What was going on the other side of this was North Korea probing Donald Trump. They were trying to figure out and also there was a track 2, 1.5 dialogue between North Korean officials and American former government officials. I was going to be part of that. That was going to be in New York for last week, and that was canceled as a result of this. The timing was just doesn't make any sense to me. And as a result of this, the Chinese did their coal ban. So what does this mean? And so really quickly—
That's $1.9 billion coal ban.
No, yeah, $1.9 billion. So either Kim Jong-un feels threatened, but is it an indication of him being weak? If that's the case, well, he may be more provocative if he's like a cornered person, you know, a cornered animal. But the other way to think about it is that he's consolidated power. He got rid of his security minister a couple weeks before. And now he feels perhaps emboldened to do whatever he wants, which makes it even more
scarier.
Volatile.
Yeah. I'll tell you what else is scary. It continues to occur to me in some of my more grim thoughts about this. They could be selling fissile material to the highest bidder. That's been a possibility all along. I mean, Pakistan did it. You know,
right.
They could do it.
So aside from the getting us through the next 3 months of a possible tit-for-tat escalation around these war games, there's a medium-term situation with the current policy. Sanctions right now aren't really working, so then North Korea is going to continue to do what it's doing. But there's an issue if sanctions work really too well. If they work too well, you've got two situations. When if they work really well, you've got now about 50, you'll have now about 25 nuclear weapons worth of material, 5 years, 50. So what happens is if the sanctions are working well, I'm a soldier who is in charge of something the size of a grapefruit, which can blow up a small building, and therefore I'm going to sell it. And if the sanctions work too well and you collapse the government, you've got 50 weapons worth of material floating around that a lot of terrorists would pay a lot of money to buy. And then it'll blow up somewhere in the United States, Israel, or Europe.
We're talking again to Philip Yun. Seconds left here. I'm looking at a question from a listener named Brian who says, is the current problem with North Korea not largely a problem of America's own making? Surely North Korea has calculated that the only way to avoid becoming another Iraq is to obtain nuclear weapons.
I think that's one very fair analysis. When I was in negotiations with the North Koreans, they said to me, we don't want to be like another Iraq. If Gaddafi had nuclear weapons, he would still be in existence.
Philip Yun, always good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Philip Yun, again, is Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer for Plowshares Fund. We are going to take a turn in our second half hour. We're actually going to be talking about containers. What about the role of containers in the global economy particularly, and containerization of America has a lot to do with capitalism and a lot to do with really the growth of the Oakland port. And it's a fascinating new study by a creator of a new podcast called Containers who will join us. Stay tuned for that. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.